Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are, why we are here, and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Greetings, Earth Explorers. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. We're coming to you live from somewhere east of the Mississippi, undisclosed location tonight. AccuWindow forecast about 90 degrees, about a quarter of the way through the Coca-Cola 600. Just thought you should know. The solar wind tonight, 676 kilometers per second. Those of you in high latitudes, watch for auroras in the sky tonight. We have four sunspots active, 12, 23, 24, 25, and 26. And there is some activity beneath the surface. The Solar Dynamics Observatory is showing us something could be coming. So you might want to wear sunscreen if you're out this weekend. Also, just in case you're up early in the morning, 4:47 on the East Coast, 3:08 in the morning on the West Coast, you're going to get one of your last chances to see the space shuttle chasing the International Space Station across the sky. I highly suggest looking at it through night vision goggles. I've done it. It is, wow, really something. But you can see it with the naked eye. Two white ships glowing, actually reflecting like mirrors going through the sky at night. Actually, it'll be early morning. Should be pretty pleasant out in the morning. No clouds on the west or east coast. It's all in the middle of the country. Lots of things in the news this week relative to space exploration. And that's really the subject of tonight's program. We're going to be talking about moon exploration, where it has been, where it is going, where it really is going. Some comments that have been made in the last three or four days, both on the political side and the science side, rather earth-shaking or moon-shaking, as I might say. So we'll probably spend the entire program on that. I think you're going to find it most interesting. We're also going to cover a little bit of Mars if we can get into it. Some rumblings in NASA about an admission that Mars maybe is perhaps not what we thought it was. Also this week, we finally laid to rest Spirit. Yes, the little solar-powered rover running around on Mars did not respond to the last poke that they sent, and so the Spirit team has been disbanded. Opportunity is still running around years after it was supposed to, but still running around nonetheless. Very great team up there at Cornell. We're very proud of them. Great job. Especially many, many hundreds of grad students have gone through that program, and it's inspired more than you can imagine. We want you to be part of the program tonight. So if you have not logged on to X Squared Radio or BBSRadio.com, you're just listening via the web. The phone numbers to call in are 530-413-4511 if you're off planet. And keep in mind our year-long open invitation to any being that wasn't born here. That's a big catch-all. You could call them extraterrestrials or ultra-terrestrials or intraterrestrials, whatever you want to call them. You have an open line here, you're safe. You can say whatever you want here, and we'll make sure that it isn't edited out. If you're west of Earth, it's 530-413-4515, and if you're east of Earth, it is 530-413-4520. By the way, I want to welcome to Sunday Nights my good friend Ramon, formerly from New York, now from Japan. We were a little worried about him. Hopefully he was in the safe zone in Japan. Appears that he is. And we welcome him to Sunday Nights. This is where the action is on BBS Radio, late night, at least on the East Coast. So give me about 40 seconds, and we will bring you the real story of the moon. Oh, yeah, you're going to hear things you haven't heard before. I know this. Hang around. 40 seconds. We'll be right back with X Squared Radio.
The spice expands consciousness. The spice is vital to space travel.
Okay, my friends, fellow Earth explorers, listeners to X Squared Radio Live, those of you that are listening to the archives, we've had a little bit of problem getting them up on the new website, but we're going to solve that. June is going to be a full month. Moon. The moon has more water than previously thought. Well, we kind of knew that a couple years ago when we launched a rock, I was going to say a ballistic missile, but it really wasn't ballistic. It was just a missile into the surface of the moon, which blew a bunch of dust up into the air. And we spectrographically analyzed that and found that there was quite a bit of water on the moon. But the moon has much more water than scientists once thought, casting doubt on theories of its creation, according to a study. Now, this is really moon shaking because you're going to hear a theory tonight that the moon was formed by some hot passerby slamming into primordial Earth, busting off a big piece of it, which oddly enough looked a little bit like our moon and is now revolving every 28 days around our planet. That's one theory. There are two other theories. One is that the Earth was here, going around the sun, minding its own business, moonless, and the moon came floating through space, and the Earth captured it in its orbit, and it has been here ever since, slowly, ever so slowly, marching away from Earth. The other theory is that the moon was here by itself in orbit, and Earth came floating through and was captured in this orbit and caught up with the moon and has been enjoying a almost geosynchronous orbit with this planet. Every 28 days it goes around us, same side facing us all the time. The latter is now the most popular theory, moon capture theory rather than Earth capture theory. Scientists measured 7 samples of magma trapped as what's called a melt inclusion within crystals, according to a paper in the Journal of Science. Now, this is really recent. The day before my birthday, May 26th, just 3 days ago. So this is really leading edge science. Okay, we're just behind the leading edge. If we paddle really hard, we can get our board up on this wave. The water content of the lunar magma was 100 times higher than previous studies have suggested. Lower quantities of water and volatile compounds on the moon when compared with the Earth and other inner planets of the solar system have long been taken as evidence the moon formed during a giant impact that had enough energy to create seas of magma, according to the Carnegie Institution's Eric Haure, the study's lead author. He says, if our samples are representative of the entire moon, this is basically the best way to calculate how much water's on the moon, Hari said. And what are the chances that the first seven samples look like Earth? Well, that's a good statistical question. That's a little bit like taking samples from the Sahara Desert or the Upper Mojave and taking them to another world and looking at them under a microscope and saying, these are representative of the planet Earth. Maybe not. The findings suggest that the impact from a Mars-sized body that formed the moon was either much hotter or much cooler than previously thought. If the moon impact was cooler, then some material, including water, wasn't molten and was locked in the interior of these samples that were taken. If there was more energy, then the rocks boiled and created a temporary atmosphere, Hari said. While the atmosphere would have been dense and short-lived, it might have allowed the still-forming Earth and Moon to exchange water. The presence of water tells you how much potential it has to sustain life, Hari said. Well, I think that's a pretty reasonable case. The more water there is, the more life there is. That just is the molecule of life, that strange combination of oxygen and hydrogen with two spare electrons floating around on it makes it possible for life to exist. Not too much life out there likes to live in liquid methane or liquid alcohol, but a lot likes to live in liquid water, or so it would seem. Now, the experiment that was done was sort of like a it was a rocket crash. They just kind of took a piece of the rocket and dropped to the surface. The National Aeronautics and Space Administration, NASA, discovered water on the moon by crashing a Centaur rocket into a crater called Cabeas. At the time, scientists involved in the discovery suggested that the water was left by impacts from meteors or comets. This is, you know, stray water that's kind of floating through space, the tail of comets as the heads boil off. Earth goes through them, and so does our moon. We pass through these giant trillion cubic yard clouds of methane every time that comet orbits past Earth. Halley does the same thing. We see the Perseids. We see various comets that we pass through, and all kinds of little rocks and pieces of gravel left behind. We pass through them over and over again, and sometimes it's pretty spectacular, and other times it's, oh, well, yeah, another meteor shower. In addition, the Cabeas impact suggested there were 1 billion gallons of water on the moon. Today's study indicates that there may be 1 billion Cabeas craters worth of water, Hari said. The method could be expanded to study water content on other planets, Hari said. Gee, I hope we don't go through the galaxy launching Centaur rockets at them in order to see how much water they have on them. You know, the inhabitants of those planets might not take too kindly to it. And I realize that it wasn't too much of a social risk at dropping an inert Centaur rocket into the Cabeas crater on the moon, but it might be seen as, you know, an act of aggression, especially if someone was living inside that planet. These melt inclusions, which we discussed just a couple minutes ago, which are used to estimate water content on Earth, were discovered in a sample by Thomas Weinreich, an undergraduate at Brown University. The melt inclusions, by the way, are about the size of a human hair. Yeah, so it's not a big, you know, piece that's done. Normally, when we're doing a melt temp or a melt reading, we take the sample on the inside of a glass tube. We sort of take a scraping up inside of a glass tube, and then we heat that up with infrared radiation while we're looking at it through a microscope. Now, we record the temperature at which we see the molecules begin to melt. And that's kind of the way that melting temperature is determined. With water, we know what the boiling temperature of water is. It's 212 degrees, plus or minus a little bit, depending on if there are any ions in the water. But we watch for reactions at 212 degrees, and that's what tells us how much water's in there. We can also use microwaves, and we can bake off the water and tell the difference in weight. But these are usually larger samples than the human hair. Telling the difference between the weight of a human hair and the weight of half of a human hair is more difficult than, say, a teaspoon size sample, say 25 grams, where you're losing 3, 4, 5, 10 grams of water. It's a little easier to measure. However, the researchers suggest their findings could mean that the theory needs to be reevaluated. And this is incredibly intelligent to see in a science article, that they have obtained empirical data. That is to say, they've made measurements, they've made observations, they watched something happen that was a little different than what their theory was. Now, in days past, years past, when you feared the retribution of the religiosity of science, you just threw that data out. You kind of left it in your notes. You really didn't include it in your paper because you didn't want to be excoriated. You didn't want to have the theory of the day blown out of the water by actual fact. That just wouldn't do. But today, science is moving fast enough, and the reputation of yesterday's scientists is so easily sullied by real data. It's moving so quickly now, and there are so many different avenues, both affiliated and non-affiliated, that it's difficult to hold it back. So here we see an admission that the theory needs to be reevaluated. It could either be that the molten Earth and proto-moon exchanged more material during the collision than believed, or that parts of the lunar interior somehow escaped the widespread melting that happens afterwards. Oh, gee, there's one more theory you guys are leaving out. And that is, or the moon and the Earth have always been separate. And that could be why the moon is mostly aluminum and titanium, gallium and other things like that, and the Earth is mostly iron and nickel. Gee, could you think that just could be possible? I would just put a sentence in there, okay? Just a sentence. Anyway, NASA announced a key decision based on 2 years ago data, and now this just fortifies it, that there's more water on the Earth or on the moon than once thought. Now, this is really important. Not so much that we could go and, you know, scoop up a pond of water and we could, you know, sow it with goldfish. Not at all. Water is key to making energy. It's key to making oxygen. It's key to obviously making life work on the moon. Now, it's going to take a little bit of energy, a little bit of intelligence, but it could be done. Now, we're going to play some recordings tonight because there were some very important decisions that were made a couple of years ago, and even more important announcements that were made that really began to encourage the world that maybe, just maybe, we have a chance to get off this rock. We can go back to exploring the stars. Maybe there is enough entrepreneurial spirit, enough will to look outside of our box, that we're willing to go back to being the explorers of space that we once were, or that our ancestors were, or our predecessors were, or the organizers were, however you want to look at it. They're out there, and we're here, and we were made in their image. So, this key decision is key to tonight's program, and it's why I want you to call in, because this is going to elicit some very strong emotions from many of you. Now, most of you that listen to this program are rah-rah, let's go to the moon. But there are some of you out there who are living real life day to day and realize, you know, I don't have enough money to go through this month. It comes down to reality. It comes down to your reality that you are stuck in an economic treadmill, a hamster wheel, and no matter how hard you pedal, it just seems to come around again, and you never get a break. You never get to step off the wheel, because as soon as you do, the wheel stops turning and everything comes up behind you. You got to get to a point where that is you have to make a change in your philosophy, a change in your perspective of that. This can be done. And maybe by tonight's program that will happen. But in any case, the lines are open. And if you want to call and say, we have no business going to the moon, we have more problems down here on Earth than we can handle, you can do that. I'll welcome it. On the other hand, if you say, you know, look, we really saw in the 60s and 70s such a boon to the planet, everything from digital watches to now laptops and internet and blah, 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 all, you know, children or children of children from the space program. And if you've ever been to any of the observatories or the public displays like the Stennis Sphere down in Mississippi, or you've been to Birmingham, or you've been to Florida, and you've seen any of the space facilities that are there, you've gone to the tours, you get a feeling, a really honest feeling for what kind of benefit we as Earthlings have had from going into space. Now, I'm the first one in line to say that most of those benefits, economic and otherwise, have been toward the military. I don't necessarily agree with that, but the crumbs from the table have been enough to carry countless entrepreneurs through to the production phase, and we are enjoying those products. So here we go. NASA has reached an important milestone for the next U.S. transportation system that will carry humans deep into space. Well, into deep space, they say. What does that mean? Deep space is anything across the street to NASA. NASA Administrator Charles Bolden announced today that the system will be based on designs originally planned for the Orion Crew Exploration Vehicle. Those plans now will be used to develop a new spacecraft known as the Multi-Purpose Crew Vehicle. Now, if you've walked up on this, and I've actually put my hands on a mock-up of it. I'm not going to say it was a prototype, but it was definitely a mock-up, full size. It looks a little bit like a beefy black Apollo capsule. Something about that shape, they learned a lot about sending it back through the atmosphere. It looks like we're going back to the old days of instead of gliding through the air and landing on a runway, we're going to splash down again and be retrieved by naval vessels. And I suppose that's a good, inexpensive way of going up and down. And perhaps most of the vehicle can be reused, and that can help lower the cost and raise the frequency, although I don't think these capsules will make multiple trips. He says, we are committed to human exploration beyond low Earth orbit, and look forward to developing the next generation of systems to take us there. He also says the NASA Authorization Act lays out a clear path forward for us by handing off transportation to the International Space Station to our private sector partners so we can focus on deep space exploration. As we aggressively continue our work on a heavy lift launch vehicle, we are moving forward with an existing contract to keep development of our new crew vehicle on track. I was down at the Stennis Sphere in Mississippi a couple of weeks ago, and I watched one of the Orion engines being tested. I can't tell you a whole lot about it, except it was really loud, and it put a lot of flame out, and it They run something like 80,000 gallons a minute down the walls of this thing through a bunch of little quarter-inch holes in order to keep the walls of the test station from reaching the 6,000 degrees that's the exit temperature of the engine. And it's quite spectacular, 180-second test, and they have several test stands there. They have their own canals to feed it water and their own underground cistern and the world's largest diesel generators to pump that water through those orifices to keep the walls cool during the test. And it's quite spectacular. I mean, even with your fingers in your ears, you can hear the power of these engines. I think they're somewhere in the neighborhood of 50,000 pounds of thrust apiece. So it's a lot, and they put four or five of these things on there and then solid boost rockets, and it's really tremendous. Lockheed Martin Corporation will continue working to develop the MPCV. This is the multipurpose crew vehicle. The spacecraft will carry four astronauts for 21-day missions and be able to land in the Pacific Ocean off the California coast. The spacecraft will have a pressurized volume of 690 cubic feet. 690 cubic feet. That's about two Cadillac Escalades inside, with 316 cubic feet of habitable space. That's about the space of one Cadillac Escalade. It is designed to be 10 times safer during ascent and entry than its predecessor, the space shuttle. I certainly hope so. They're supposed to be very safe. They've done a lot of tests with these rockets launching satellites. He goes on to say, this selection does not indicate a business-as-usual mentality for the NASA programs. This is Douglas Cook, Associate Administrator for the agency's Exploration Systems Mission Directorate in Washington. The Orion government and industry team has shown exceptional creativity in finding ways to keep costs down through management techniques, technical solutions, and innovation. A lot of this has to do with consolidating logistics, consolidating purchasing systems, and through techniques that we learned in the automotive business, which is to reduce the number of suppliers to a manageable group, you know, to build the average vehicle. You probably have upwards of 250 suppliers, and you try to work that down to smaller and smaller numbers. Now, it doesn't sound very smart, right? Because if something goes wrong with one of your suppliers, you have no backup. It is smart as far as lowering your cost, but as the Japanese are now learning, if you have one plant that happens to be in the neighborhood of a particular nuclear power plant that has a problem, you can't ship those parts anymore. In fact, you can't work people at those plants. So you have to have a backup. So it does count to have contingencies in this business. And that does drive your costs up. You know, it's like training a star and a co-star, a main dancer and an understudy. It's can drive the cost up. So, you know, Mr. Cook has the right idea, and he talks about the Orion government and industry team making smart industry decisions. That is the right way to go, always has been. That's how you get away from the $1,000 hammers and $30,000 toilet seats. The multipurpose crew vehicle is based on the Orion design requirements for traveling beyond low Earth orbit, LEO. Oh, they always have these acronyms. L-E-O, right, L-O-L. The MPCV will serve as the exploration vehicle that will carry the crew to space, provide emergency abort capability, sustain the crew during the space travel, and provide safe reentry from deep space return velocities. So this is kind of interesting. I'm going to play this announcement for you. This is an announcement that there were no plans to publicly announce a base on the moon. You'll see as soon as you hear this come out. It's kind of interesting to hear this admission. And while it's booting up, I'll just say you're getting a little bit of one side of the face and the other side of the face out of NASA. On the one hand, they're saying, no, we're not going back to the moon. We have no plans to go there. And yet they constantly talk about heavy lift vehicles, low gravity work, and this is where it comes from. So this is the statement. Here we go.
The U.S. Vision for Space Exploration guides NASA's far-reaching missions of discovery, which will be empowered by a new generation of safe, reliable, and cost-effective space transportation systems. Today, NASA and its partners are designing and developing systems that will carry new generations of explorers on fresh journeys of infinite possibilities. While using the latest tools and techniques, rocket engineers are building on a foundation of knowledge gained from almost 50 years of experience to enhance mission success in the complex business of space exploration. The Crew Launch Vehicle will be the new flagship of America's space fleet. The first test flights are scheduled for later this decade, with crew transport to the International Space Station planned for early next decade. Beginning late next decade, this two-stage rocket will carry the Crew Exploration Vehicle capsule to Earth orbit to rendezvous with its ride to the moon. The inline design puts the crew above the propulsion system, and the integrated launch abort system on top of the crew capsule can move astronauts quickly away in case of an emergency, dramatically improving safety. The larger of the two systems is the cargo launch vehicle, which is about the size of the Apollo Saturn V. It will provide the capability pioneers need to survive and thrive while exploring new territories. This heavy lift system will loft the equipment and supplies needed for trips to the moon as the first step toward much longer journeys to Mars. The cargo vehicle's Earth departure stage will carry the lunar lander to orbit and dock with the crew capsule. After checking out all systems, the Earth departure stage will perform a translunar injection burn, and it's off to the moon. Arriving in lunar orbit, the crew will descend to the moon's surface in the lunar lander. Capable of carrying twice as many astronauts to the moon's surface as did the Apollo lander, the crew will be able to stay for more than a week at a time. When their job is done, they will launch in the lunar lander and rendezvous with the crew capsule, which is waiting for them in lunar orbit to begin their return trip home. With its roots in Apollo and Space Shuttle, and its future in traveling to the Moon and Mars, the crew and cargo launch vehicles will be America's next step toward expanding scientific knowledge through space exploration. For more information about NASA's exploration launch vehicles, visit us on the web at nasa.gov.
There you have it. That's the advertisement. Now, that is a really slick video that's put out by NASA to talk about the Orion program with the Ares 1 and Ares 5 rocket systems. Very nice stuff, and they're currently testing it. And they made the announcement that, yes, they plan on going to the moon, they plan on going on to Mars, but they don't really talk about what they're going to do when they get there. Yes, we're going to go there, we're going to gather up some rocks, and we're going to come back. And you know what we want to do is we want to build a moon base there, obviously. Now, that's what we're going to kind of build the case for tonight. Now, you can find thousands of renditions of moon bases out there on the web. I mean, there are all kinds of configurations. All of them, you know, show nice little campers laid out on the surface of the moon or domes, much like you know, what we would see on Antarctica. You know, keep in mind, it's very cold and very treacherous on the surface of the moon. Most of this stuff is just eye candy for the Trekkies and Jedis. The only real practical moon base must be hundreds of feet below the surface. I'm sorry, it's just not possible to build safe habitats on the surface of the moon. Not that that you're willing to sleep when the wind blows. Because the problem that you're going to have is these little tiny meteor showers or solar flares that occur, and you're not going to have enough shielding to protect yourself from that stuff. The smart thing to do is to land on one of the deeper craters and then tunnel into the wall for a quick shelter that will protect the occupants from high-energy particle showers from space. The structure would be safer than anything built on Earth, as the planet is tectonically pretty quiet and has only 1/6 the gravity of Earth. So you really don't have a high probability of cave-ins if you're going to dig back into the side. And we have lots of experience doing that down here already. We've got great tunneling machines that have bored, you know, tunnels underneath the English Channel and who knows where. Certainly we could bore through lunar rock. Now, if I've thought of it, then someone else here on Earth or beyond Earth has thought of it. No one is going to have a hotel sitting out there for salt grain sized meteorites to grind away during a 500 kilometer per second space storm. So, you know, there are thoughts out there. There are official things that have been said. And some of them have come from our own government. And that strange thing, not a strange thing, maybe the unique thing about our government is as we change hands from one person to another, one president can kind of undo what the other president has done. This is a short piece from Bruno the Questionable. He's got several hundred videos out there, so he's quite prolific, and this one's well produced. And it's on colonizing the moon. It's about 10 minutes long. We got started a little bit late, so I'm going to go ahead and play it. Here we go.
Since the beginning of time, man has been fascinated by the moon.
One giant leap for mankind. All systems are go.
After 40 years, we're going back to the moon.
Today, I announce a new plan to extend a human presence across our solar system. Beginning no later than 2008, we will send a series of robotic missions to the lunar surface to research and prepare for future human exploration, with the goal of living and working there for increasingly extended periods of time.
Bush's announcement opened a new frontier. It committed NASA to returning a man to the moon by as early as 2017 and building long-term lunar settlements.
When we're talking about going back to the moon, we're talking about not just going there to stay 3 days and come home with some scientific samples. We're talking about the idea of staying, learning to live there, or learning to actually live off the land using the resources that we find.
The new program is forcing scientists to face up to a new series of problems. One of the most important is rocket design. A permanent lunar base requires a lot more equipment, so NASA is designing missions using two spacecraft for each trip.
We're talking about a lunar mission here that has a lot more capability than the Apollo missions had back in the late 60s and early 70s. So what we'll do is we'll launch one mission from Earth. That's the cargo vehicle with the lander. We'll launch a second mission, is the crew.
To break out of the Earth's gravitational field, these huge rockets will have to accelerate at over 24,000 miles an hour. That's around 23 times the speed of sound. Several days later, these enormous craft will rendezvous in space and perform an extraordinarily intricate maneuver as they line up with only centimeters of tolerance and dock.
After this rendezvous occurs, we will inject to the moon. We'll go into orbit around the moon.
The lander will carry everything for the crew to survive, including all their oxygen, water, and power supplies. The first return journey will cost around $100 billion. It would have cost even more, but NASA is relying on at least some technologies developed back in the 1960s.
The guys who designed the Apollo missions were pretty bright. They got all the physics right. So the reason you would pick a capsule, for example, is because a capsule is the right shape for coming back through the atmosphere of the Earth at very high speeds. So we tried to borrow as much of that as we could.
What is technologically new and totally untested is building a permanent lunar settlement and learning to live in the most difficult environment man has ever faced. Which is why, in the Arizona desert, NASA is testing a new generation of spacesuits, specifically designed for long-term missions. During the Apollo program, the spacesuits restricted astronauts to a maximum of 6 hours on the lunar surface. The new suits will allow them to stay on it much longer and explore in much more detail.
We've literally only scratched the surface on the moon. We've gone there and we've dug little trenches, we've made cores a few meters deep, but we really don't even know what the moon is all about. We don't know what's in the permanently shadowed craters at the South Pole. We don't know what's more than a few meters below the surface.
...60 feet below the Gulf of Mexico, NASA has built a simulation of a lunar habitat. It's called NEMO. Here, scientists are trying to simulate the totally alien and unfamiliar environment lunar inhabitants will face.
The crew is actually going to train for probably a number of years before they even come to a lunar habitat. So they'll probably understand each other's little idiosyncrasies, you know, what makes people happy, what kind of are turnoffs to folks. Go downstairs to the galley in the wardroom area. This is basically the amount of personal space we expect a crew member to possibly have on a lunar mission. Hopefully they'd be able to live within that for 6 months at a time.
Outside, astronauts are using weighted backpacks to simulate working in 1/6 gravity.
It's very similar to, say, being on a pogo stick a little bit in terms of just the way that you walk.
NEMO has shown that the problems of isolation and reduced gravity can be overcome. What's going to be more difficult is living in a dead and sterile environment where there are none of the ingredients of life. There's no oxygen, no water, and no means of growing food. Yet the moon may not be as dead as it appears.
There's lots of things we can exploit on a moon for our benefit. For one thing, the surface of the moon is covered with metal oxides. In fact, the soils on the moon are 40% oxygen by weight. That alone is a tremendous benefit.
Oh, hey! There is orange soil! Hey, it is! I can see it from here! It's orange!
There's also a lot of other resources available on the moon. There's hydrogen, there's nitrogen.
If some of these could be exploited, they'd make colonizing the moon much more realistic. Larry Clark works for one of the big US space contractors. He spent years studying the chemical composition of lunar rock.
Good. Tight.
Several years ago, he began putting his ideas to the test.
We're ready to evacuate the system. Let's open the recycle loop.
He bought large quantities of artificial moon dust and compressed it in a furnace. Then it was heated up.
I think we need to look at TC6. And we're secure.
Slowly, by a process of trial and error, Clark found that when the mixture reached 800 degrees centigrade, something magic happened.
I see water in there.
He turned moon dust into drinking water. And that's just the beginning of what's possible. With unlimited supplies of water, you can manufacture breathable oxygen too.
You don't have to have a continuous supply train from Earth launching these commodities, water and oxygen, the basic commodities.
Suddenly, the dream of living and working on the moon looks within our reach.
We can extend the length of the stay that astronauts are going to be on the moon.
By golly, this time goes fast.
Rather than having to come back after a week, we can keep up there definitely.
Clark's breakthrough opens the way to self-sufficient lunar settlements.
Just like we use resources here on Earth in order to live off the land, you know, we mine the minerals from the Earth, we cut down trees and make houses out of them. You can do the same thing on the moon.
Today, after gazing at the moon for thousands of years, we may be on the verge of colonizing it. We may never look at the moon in the same way again.
Well, that is quite a trip. And the video is kind of cool, too. If you want to check it out, you can look at Colonizing the Moon by Bruno the Questionable. Very nicely done. And good audio, too. It kind of keeps you up to date. And I'll explain some of this when we come back after the break. We're going to take a quick, let's see. We got about 9 minutes. So I'll go ahead and keep the phone lines open. 530-413-4511. 530-413-4515. And by the way, those of you that want to step out and just listen, you can do so. Our conference line is up and running. It is 712-432-0075. And then put in the access code 318-116-pound. And then you can listen on your Bluetooth while you're walking through the mall tonight. It only works live, doesn't work on the archives, so you can keep up with us while we're broadcasting live. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. So when a president makes an announcement that Earth is going back to the moon for extended work, it is going to happen, okay? This won't be NASA money. This will be multinational funding that is vital for the survival of mankind in this solar system. Also, private companies can see that the wealth of this world must be expanded if we are to have the kind of financial frontier that can cause us to evolve. Now, there has been some work done on this. Some entrepreneurs have started to look at space tourism as a way of making money. I think that there are individuals out there who would pay almost anything. Some of them have more money than brains, got their money in the dot-com era or investing in one social network or another. and want to spend a little bit of their time at least part of the way off planet. And so they're willing to pay for an hour's flight to get off the world and go weightless for a little while and throw up into a bag. That being said, there are private industries who do see the benefits. Low gravity is an excellent area in which to make pharmaceuticals, in which to make metals and all kinds of coatings. The moon is rich in minerals, which we have to spend quite a lot of money to extract here on Earth. Of course, the personnel can breathe air and take their lunch with them and eat while listening to AM radio. Not much of that on the moon, but it will come. And to say that NASA has all the resources to be able to make this happen is just naive. It just is. It is a multinational desire to get there. And yes, NASA may lead the way, but it is definitely not going to be the only one involved. And it can be said, this was said in the late 60s and early 70s, he who controls the moon controls the Earth. And it seems as though wanting to control the Earth is a really big deal, because there are all kinds of little madmen running around various deserts with various small arms shooting in the air, thinking that they can do it. And we also have elected officials who don't run around with small arms, but want to run around with small brains and big mouths, and they think they can do it. So we'll see where that goes. But as I said, the human race needs to return to the stars. And that's what tonight's program is about. We will get back to it when we come back after this musical break. Get something to drink, a quick snack, come back, because we'll be back with more X Squared Radio after this. A more beautiful voice has scarcely breathed air on this planet. Lorena McKinnitt. Absolutely marvelous. Glad she could join us tonight on X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, coming to you live somewhere east of the Mississippi. Our AccuWindow forecast, 82 degrees. Stars are out tonight. If you're out early in the morning on the East Coast, 4:47, look up to the west, northwest, and you will see the space station coming over with the space shuttle close behind. Those of you that live on the northwest coast in Washington or Oregon can do the same thing at 3:08 in the morning. Might be good, since tomorrow's a holiday, either to stay up or get early and go out, because this is the second to the last time you're ever going to be able to see this sight. It's really fabulous with a pair of binoculars, especially with a pair of night vision goggles. It's quite something to see two ships traveling somewhere around 18,000 miles an hour, just a couple hundred miles away. As you're preparing for this spring, and we've tried to tell you on this program about preparedness, our condolences to all of those that have been affected by water, by wind, by tornadoes, by hail. The loss of life has been unacceptable, perhaps unavoidable. The damage to property is almost immeasurable. However, some of those families that left their abodes right before the devastating winds tore it from its foundation had a little red bag with them. That red bag came from an emergency preparedness storehouse. Maybe some of them thought ahead and had something to be able to take care of them and their family, and maybe a neighbor or two for one or two days without the Red Cross or FEMA having to catch up with them. Maybe they didn't miss a meal. Maybe they didn't go through the night thirsty. Maybe they were able to take care of some minor cuts and abrasions on their own because they were prepared. And that's what I'm asking you to do tonight. To go to 1-800-PREPARE.com. My friend Paul Faust and his firefighter buddies in New York shortly after 9/11 saw a great need. There were some small sites out there, slow responding, limited lists of supplies, and they thought that they would put together a superstore of emergency preparedness items. So go to 1-800-PREPARE.com. Pick up a 72-hour kit or something larger, more comprehensive. Some of these things you don't have to think about for 25 years. Once you buy it, you've got the protection that you need. Put in the code Brooks, B-R-O-O-K-S, on your way checking out, and they'll give you an extra 10% off as a courtesy. So visit our friends, 1-800-PREPARE.com. Those of you that have read the book, Remembering the Future, The Physics of the Soul and Time Travel, this came out October of last year, went to the top of the charts on Amazon. It is still in the top 100 on Amazon in the self-help genre. It is there because the words in this book will ignite something inside you to let you know there is a way to turn around the scarcity in your life. There is a way to manifest the dream which you can learn how to build. Yes, you can have stuff if that's what you want, but you can be what you want to be, and you can do what you want to do. You can do what you desire, and you can become happy. And that is something that you and those around you will appreciate. You can turn life on earth into life on heaven. because you'll have the tools to be able to do so. Some of it is meditation, yes, and there are lots of books on meditation out there. I think they're probably all good. But this book teaches you that there is a mathematical rhythm, a resonance to making this work. It is proven. I've done it. I've accomplished my dreams with this formula. I've interviewed those who accomplished their dreams and validated the formula. They didn't know about the formula, but I figured if there was one way to make the universe resonate and support what it is you desire, then successful people have found that way. And you know what? There wasn't a lucky one among them. No, sir, not one. They all worked hard, and they all worked long hours. And to them, it wasn't even work. It was joy. It was fun. Like the Buddha says, once your foot is on the path, you are already at your destination. Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. Pick it up today at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Borders, Books & Million, wherever you want to. Or if you want the autographed version and the audio version for free, you can pick it up at rememberingthefuturebook.com. It's also available in Kindle and Nook. And the pictures that are in the book are all available in color for free right on the website, rememberingthefuturebook.com. Now, back to our discussion tonight. We're talking about the decision and the anti-decision and the political gyrations and the scientific consternations about returning to the moon. What does it mean? Are we ready for it? Are we ready for it as a scientific community? Are we ready for it as a social community? Are we ready for it as a race? I want your ideas, your thoughts. 530-413-4511 if you are off-planet. 530-413-4515 if you are west of Earth. 530-413-4520 if you are east of Earth. Now, recently, an individual named Dennis Wingo, I don't know if he's related to Harry Wingo. Harry Wingo is the Chief Energy Counsel for Google in Washington. But Dennis Wingo was interviewed and was asked the question, why should we go back to the moon? What does it mean? What's the value of us going back to the moon? Here's what he said. He has a website, Saving the Earth by Colonizing the Moon, and it's GaiaSelene.com.
The reason that we want to go back to the moon is related to the future, obviously, of our civilization. There was a press release put out by the World Wildlife Federation about 2, maybe 3 years ago now, stating that we needed the equivalent of 2 more Earth's resources to support future global populations. My response to that, which I outlined in my book, Moon Rush, was that fabulous. We have several million Earths, each one with their own unique resources that have the potential to contribute to the well-being of the Earth's population. The resources that are out there in our solar system are tremendously more than what are available to us on the small part of the Earth that is available for resource exploration and exploitation. For example, there is an asteroid called 3554 Amun. And Amun is approximately 1 kilometer or 0.6 of a mile in diameter. And this asteroid has approximately $20 trillion worth of valuable metals. And these metals include iron, nickel, cobalt, and what we call platinum group metals, which are the metals that are critical to our industrial civilization for catalysts like the catalytic converter that's in your car has platinum and palladium. Platinum is used in the manufacturing of gasoline from crude oil. Platinum and the platinum group metals are used in many, many applications. The LCD screens that we all love with our computers, they have platinum. Hard disk drives The coatings have platinum. So there's a tremendous number of applications related to how our civilization works that are dependent upon platinum group metals. And these are very, very valuable metals. Right now, the price of platinum in the middle of 2006 is over $1,100 per ounce. We know that these resources are out there in the asteroids because we have meteorites here on the Earth that we've been able to study, and we know the composition so that we know they have these platinum group metals. We're already mining asteroidal resources here on the Earth, such as at Sudbury in Canada, which is an ancient asteroid impact. There is considerable debate, but it seems at least probable that the Vredefort impact in South Africa that is associated with what's called the Marinsky Reef, which is a major global producer of platinum and platinum group metals, is an asteroid remnant. And so we're already using asteroidal resources on the Earth. These resources have been transformed over billions of years of being on the Earth. It's a lot of expense and environmental degradation to get these resources. But on the moon, no matter how far back you go, there's been no weathering on the moon. So if a nickel iron asteroid has hit the moon and has either remained relatively intact or is splattered about as fragments, that those fragments are still there. And those fragments have been unmodified since the day they hit. And therefore, they're there available as a resource.
Well, as luck would have it, I actually built a catalytic converter plant back just after 9/11, and he is exactly right. These platinum group metals are expensive. Rhodium is about $50 a gram. That's about that's pretty close to $2,000 an ounce. Palladium and platinum are both used in combination to catalyze, that is to say, they promote the oxidation of partially oxidized carbon to fully oxidized carbon, which would be carbon dioxide, because we don't want to admit, we don't want to emit carbon monoxide. What we want to do is we want to fully oxidize that to carbon dioxide, because then it can be processed by plants and other things. We also try to capture the hydrocarbons from the extra rich mixture that has to be run in order to get the vehicle started and run smoothly. In the old days, we used to call this a choke, where we'd actually put a plate over the carburetor and make it suck more gas into the intake manifold to increase the gas per air ratio and make it run while it was cold. This was a highly pollutive state. I mean, it just chugged hydrocarbons out into the atmosphere. Now what we try to do is capture those and hold on to them until the catalytic converter lights off. And once it lights off, then it goes ahead and finishes the combustion of those hydrocarbons. And this is why we have oxygen sensors up and down the exhaust pipe, so that we can adjust that fuel management system. And actually, the engine makes more horsepower, and it's a lot less pollutive. That is to say, you get more mileage for the same amount of fuel burned, less milligrams of hydrocarbons per mile than ever before. This is why a 2009 Mustang makes a lot more horsepower than a 1969 Mustang and gets three times the mileage, almost 40 miles to the gallon if you're at freeway speeds on cruise control. So kind of interesting that you can make 400 horsepower and still get over 30 miles per gallon. So Dennis is a rich resource, and we asked the question, what kind of resources are available on the moon? I mean, if we are going to have to haul everything that we will ever need with us from the Earth to the moon, then it's not really practical, is it? But that's not really the case. Dennis does a really good job of explaining this. Again, his website is GaiaSelene.com if you want to check it out. Here's Dennis again.
The moon is only 3 days away, logistically speaking, and the asteroids, it takes about 2 years to go there and come back, that it makes logical sense that the moon is the first step in a chain that enables us to completely develop the resources of the inner solar system for the benefit of people here on Earth. And the MASCONs are mass concentrations on the moon that's been identified by the gravity mapping satellites. They're pretty big, and the possibility certainly exists because we know that the moon has at least a small metallic core. And by definition, since the moon is an accretion of a lot of asteroids that come together, that we know for a fact that today that at least the core of the moon, it's several hundred kilometers or several hundred miles in diameter, is a nickel iron object. Then the question becomes, are the mass concentrations asteroidal resources or nickel iron impactors? Certainly possible. But I think the nearer term resource potential is in the smaller, later asteroids that have hit and have impacted the surface that give their presence away by the magnetic fields, the localized magnetic fields that they create on the moon. And there are several of those. And I think that's the first place to begin looking.
Now, the idea of going to the moon as a mineral rush, actually, Dennis has a book called Moon Rush, which is a little bit like a play on words to go along with the gold rush. And we kind of talk a little bit about that tonight, about, you know, what does it mean that 3 days away, logistically speaking. Yes, it's high risk, but so was going out west with nothing but a 3-foot-wide wooden wagon and a pan and a pickaxe and a boatload of kids to pan for gold. Once you got the gold panned and into your sacks, then you had to fend off those that didn't want to go through all that wading and mudding and sunburn and mosquito bites and freezing cold at night and baking during the day. They just steal it from you when you got it done. So you have all those hazards. What about this moon rush? What about this idea that there is ultimate wealth sitting up there just above us, and that we don't have to go out into space 2 years and risk being away from a gravitational body where we could be protected away from what could be underground shelter out there in the middle of space, no way to radio home, no way to be rescued, and get yourself wealthy if you can't spend it, if there's nothing you can do with it. But there is something you can do with it, because the next trillionaires are going to be in not only moon exploration, but moon development. Here's what Dennis has to say about that.
In 1848, when a guy was standing in a stream and he looked down and there's gold, and gold was really easy to find at that time, and so people came from all over the world, a lunar moon rush and lunar platinum development is going to require a lot of capital. On the moon, it's going to be capital intensive. In the typical chicken and egg irony that is space, no one is going to go and do it until someone goes and does it. So you've got to find someone who's either crazy enough, stubborn enough, and rich enough. The first thing that we're going to do is obviously oxygen. I am not as enthusiastic about the lunar ice as some of my compatriots are, because of the difficulties of operating in an environment that's only 35 degrees above absolute zero. That imposes tremendous requirements on your machinery. Metals that perfectly bend in a room environment would shatter like glass at those temperatures. Unless we find deposits of lunar ice that's pure ice, like meters thick, I don't think the lunar ice is the first resource. I think oxygen, either from regolith derived at the poles or regolith from locations other than the poles will be processed in oxygen. The key determinant of what happens next is kind of the way that you do the oxygen production. For every ton of oxygen that you produce 2.4 tons of iron. The in-situ resource process that will work is a process that actually takes and considers the other elements that come from the oxygen production and produces those simultaneously. And if you look at them in sequence of temperature or volatility, it's magnesium, it's iron, silicon, and then you get to aluminum. Those are the four that's in any regolith that's on the lunar surface. And those metals can be used for building habitats, because I think the most important thing that we need to do on the moon is create as much living space as possible, as quickly as possible.
Now we're going to talk about living space because, you know, as I have stated many times, I think that the most logical place to stay alive and to thrive on the moon is just underneath the surface. We have some interest in that, you know, that we have talked about hollow moon theory from time to time, but I got to tell you, there's not a lot out there on it. There's just not a lot of information. Everything that, you know, we theoretical physicists talk about as far as hollow moon theory goes is largely speculation because there just is no data. We don't have seismological data like we have here on Earth, where we have listening stations all around the Earth and the USGS, where every time there's a large earthquake, and goodness knows we've had our share of those in the last year, we get a fairly good CAT scan of the Earth as these vibrations go through our planet. We don't have that kind of data from the moon. What we do know about the moon is looking at it from ground to Earth, even with an ordinary pair of binoculars or through a Walmart 3-inch reflecting telescope, is that there are a lot of crater impacts on the moon. Now, some are big, but the vast majority of them are small, like about the size of a drinking cup. These small ones are made by meteorites that are about the size of a grain of sand or perhaps a BB, but they're traveling at 25, 30,000 miles an hour. That's like getting hit by a 50 caliber machine gun bullet. That's a 550 grain bullet traveling at 3,000 feet per second. That's, you know, not really that fast when you compare it to a ice cube traveling at 20,000 miles an hour. That's a lot of energy. If you ever saw the movie Eraser with Arnold Schwarzenegger, that's about what happens when an aluminum pellet is accelerated to those kinds of speed with a magnetic rail gun. It can be quite devastating, the amount of energy. So when asked the question, you know, what are we talking about here? We were talking about some rich people or rich nations putting together resources, because that's the way we measure things here on Earth, is by money. We don't really measure them by the amount of gold that is offset by that dollar, right? I mean, when we talk about dollars, doggone it, we talk about dollars. We talk about $1 million. We don't talk about so many thousand ounces of gold. But in reality, that's really what we're talking about. When you think about, you know, how much gold is worth today, in reality, gold is worth the same amount today as it was in 1800, 1849. Gold will buy the same amount of land today that it bought in 1849. Because goods for goods, gold, that never changes in value. That's why it's a hedge against inflation. It's the dollar that changes value, not the gold. Yeah, it takes over $1,000 to make up an ounce of gold now, but $1,000 buys the same that an ounce of gold would buy in 1849. So that is what inflation is. So when we're talking about the wealth of what it takes to go to the moon, the wealth of what we would gain from the moon, We're not talking about dollars. We're not talking about money. We're not talking about rupees or euros or yuan or dollars. We're talking about metric tons of precious metals. Platinum, rhodium, palladium, gallium. Dennis talks about a little bit about this wealth. Listen, this is what he has to say.
The most important thing that we need to do on the moon is create as much living space as possible, as quickly as possible. Therefore, if you're producing a ton of oxygen and you've got 2.4 tons of iron, you can begin to make structures. And if you're producing 10 tons of oxygen, you have 24 tons of iron. 24 tons of iron can make a pretty darn good pressure vessel. And that pressure vessel, guess what? It has radiation protection because it's iron. So it's a multiplicative effect. It's the bootstrap. It's a classic bootstrap. I have on my desk at my office a 15-kilogram nickel iron asteroid.
That's about 35 pounds.
It's called Cielo de Campo. It's from Argentina. That object has 87 grams per ton of gallium and 400 grams of germanium per ton. Germanium and gallium are very, very important in terms of high-efficiency solar cells. So you're going to see very high-value metals brought back, the platinum group metals, obviously. Then the secondary, the galliums, the germaniums, maybe cobalt. The bulk of the material by weight will be used out there, while the higher value materials will be brought back here to help support our civilization. That is a really important one that I think we're going to have to export from the Earth to there. You send a shipment of coal to the moon because it's tremendously important on the moon, because you can make mild steel. You can make a real nice Inconel steel with carbon, iron, and nickel. And Inconel is what the space shuttle main engine bell is made out of. Very high temperature, very high strength steel. So I think carbon, at least to the point way in the future to where you're getting carbon from the asteroids, or unless some of the deposits on the moon that the hydrogen may be tied up as CH4, maybe methane, I think carbon is going to be an Earth export rather than an in-situ-derived lunar product, because if you look at the numbers, there's just nothing loose there. That's why God made nitrogen. Send ammonia. A shipment of ammonia to the moon. So you got nitrogen in liquid form, so you get a bunch of hydrogen at the same time. You take it up there, and then you disassociate it. Well, guess what? You got a bunch of hydrogen now, and you got a bunch of nitrogen for your buffer gas, for your breathe gas. Yeah. But if you're doing high production rates on the oxygen, you're going to get enough of the buffer gas to supply most of the human-related needs. But I think nitrogen, because nitrogen is important in the growth cycle of plants, I think we're going to be sending ammonia. It's going to be an Earth export to the moon as well. Equally important in relation to the resources exported back to the Earth is there was a book written as far back, it was written in 1965. And it was actually, I relied on it a lot for my research in Moonrush, because it was a brilliant book when it came out. It was by a gentleman by the name of Neil Ruzin, called The Case for the Moon. Brilliant book talking about manufacturing on the moon. He invented the cryostat. And the cryostat is used all over industry today. But the cryostat was invented because you could basically, in a perfect vacuum on the moon, you could dial in whatever temperature you wanted for industrial processes. Nanotechnology is a big thing everybody's talking about. It's the big wave of the future. But nanotechnology requires a vacuum. If you just had an atmosphere in there, that's too much friction for the micro machines to work. So in nanotechnology, what they do is the last part of the process, they put it in a vacuum, and then they have what's called a witness material, which is a platinum group metal, like palladium, and then they encapsulate it in as good of a vacuum as they can, but then the palladium attracts the residual molecules. And so the inside of this chip is in a vacuum. So I think something like nanotechnology manufacturing will be an export, a manufacturing export. Right now, there's a global shortage of silicon for solar arrays. Now, I don't think too much we'll bring just back bulk silicon, but bulk silicon is one of the byproducts of oxygen production. For every ton of oxygen that you're getting that's not coming from FeO3, which is an iron base, but it's coming from silicon, you get about a ton of silicon. One of the isotopes of silicon called silicon-28 has four times the thermal dissipation of standard isotropic silicon. Silicon-28 is very difficult to purify on the Earth. It's actually, the only place they get it is from Russia. And where they get it in Russia is from the same factories that are used to make nuclear weapons, because it's done from the same process that they use to separate the different isotopes of uranium for a nuclear bomb. But on the moon, it's much easier because you have the high vacuum. And depending, again, on your process for oxygen production, you'll have vapor, silicon vapor. And so it's much easier to use a gaseous diffusion method on the moon, and it's very good vacuum. In a high production environment, we could produce a tremendous amount of silicon-28 that could help continue the progress forward in silicon chips. We could export tons and tons and tons of that back to the Earth. The oxygen is the leak. The platinum group metals is the trickle. The silicon-28, the manufacturing and all, that's where the kind of the torrent begins. And so what I see is a very strong possibility that we could have a situation by the year 2100, if we want to do this, if we really care about the future and the 9 billion people that will be here by 2050, most mining of heavy metals will be done off Earth, where there's no environmental impact, there's no effluent clogging the stream, there's no farmland destroyed. And then the manufactured goods, the high-tech materials that are very difficult to make on the Earth, after a certain point, it will become more cost-effective to build them on the moon, because transportation costs will fall, and we could just do it. And actually, all of these things don't weigh that much, but they have a lot of value. And so I think that's where the moon will go, and I think at that point is where the thought of a real lunar colony becomes to be more than just a fantasy of the future and a reality.
Well, there you have the total idea from someone who is qualified to talk about it. That's Dennis Wingo. He's the author of the book Moon Rush, and maybe it won't become a movie because it's so real. You know, that takes care of the mining operation and all of the support operations that go from there. You know, you've got to have food, you've got to have water, you've got to have clothing, you've got to have medical care. You have to have, all of those things that make it possible to live on a planet with 1/6 the gravity of Earth. Now, keep in mind that at 1/6 your weight, for a while, you're going to be very, very strong. So if you ever had the idea that you would like to fly with just wings strapped on your arms, you could probably do it on the moon, and you wouldn't break a bone doing it. But you wouldn't want to grow up on the moon because you would never be able to return to Earth. Your bones wouldn't be dense enough to be able to handle Earth gravity. But at least we don't have to worry about affecting the ecology on the moon. We don't have to worry about snail darters or algae or the atmosphere at all. And speaking of ecology, how would we feed ourselves while we're on the moon? I mean, we can't have McDonald's delivering food from the Earth to the moon. We can barely feed what we've got here now. As prolific as the Earth is, we do not manage the food producing of this world very well. Now, some countries do it well. I don't think any countries do it as well as the United States. We just have a way for very few people to produce a tremendous amount of food, and we feed the world. But there are fertile grounds in Mexico and Russia and Africa that just aren't used. They're just not managed well, and all you have is seed in the ground, tractors to run it, and people to process the food, and you've got the ability to feed your own nation. But we're not doing it very well. We wouldn't be able to do it and feed the moon as well. So as it turns out, They are already designing a hydroponic greenhouse that sets up the biosphere. Yes, it can make some of that nitrogen-oxygen mix that we need. The problem I see is that the plastic housing is subject to small meteorite impacts. But I want you to hear this for yourself. This is Gene Giacomelli. He's with the University of Arizona. And if anyone has ever built a biosphere, kind of like what you saw in the movie with those crazy actors, Pauly Shore and his buddy, this is kind of it. This is the real deal here.
Giacomelli, and I'm the director of the Controlled Environment Agriculture Center and a member of the Agricultural and Biosystems Engineering Department at the University of Arizona in Tucson, Arizona. My colleagues, Mr. Phil Sadler and Lane Patterson, as well as other faculty and staff, have been working on controlled environments related to production of food in space for many years. Controlled environment agriculture is taught here. It requires that you understand plants and controlling the environment of the plant to produce optimally and when desired. Capabilities and understanding of controlled environments offer many opportunities for food production here on Earth, but also for food production and life support as we travel into space. Bioregenerative life support is controlling the environment, recycling resources, and reutilizing them in a closed system for long-term sustained presence on other planets as we travel into space. The benefits are to minimize the amount of resupply necessary as we sustain life on other planets. Other benefits include information and technologies that we will develop in this program that will help and be utilized for food production systems on Earth. If we can produce our consumables in situ, then we minimize or reduce or possibly eliminate the amount of resupply that is necessary to maintain the sustaining life system on the other planet. Our prototype lunar greenhouse is an inflatable structure that is compacted to a 1 meter length as it's stowed and transported to the planet. And then it is expanded to a full dimension of 5.5 meters long and 2.1 meters in diameter. It is covered with a flexible membrane and it has an internal rib system to help maintain support as it will need to be buried in the materials of the planet, and that will help protect it from micrometeorites and galactic cosmic rays for those who are living and working in the system. The aerial environment around the planet is controlled by an environmental system to maintain air temperature, air relative humidity, and provide a optimum growing environment for the plant. Carbon dioxide is also supplied for photosynthesis by people breathing in oxygen and giving off carbon dioxide. In our case, we are supporting it with CO2 provided artificially from a bottle. An additional key component for plant growth is light for photosynthesis. Special water-cooled lamps provide the energy for plant growth. They are 6,000 watts of electric-powered high-pressure sodium vapor lamps. The water cooling extracts significant amount of heat from the lamp so that the plant can grow almost up and touch the lamp. In the future, these lamps may be replaced by fiber optic cables, light pipes, which will direct the natural solar radiation down onto the plants. The hydroponic system provides the nutrients to the root system of the plant within a membrane envelope, which is supported by a cable at each end of the structure. The nutrient solution is introduced at each end. It flows across the root system of the plant and it discharges in the middle of the structure. The nutrient water then is recycled continuously. We have done this individually and we have done this together, which is called multi-cropping. The plants will have to share the same environment, aerial environment, temperature, relative humidity, and light, but we are able to provide different hydroponic nutrient solutions to satisfy the growth simultaneously of strawberry, sweet potato, tomato, and lettuce. It's important to provide many, many types of crops because the CRU requires a diversity of different crops to maintain a diverse diet. The prototype lunar greenhouse requires monitoring and control for all of its systems, including the plants. And we do this automatically using computer control and sensors. We monitor, collect data, store that data, and analyze it, and use this as decision support to help us monitor and control. This can be done from anywhere in the world through the internet, having web cameras for live feeds, but also a significant amount of data that is used to analyze the environment and determine how the plants are growing. Think of this as a robotic mechanism, which is producing plants to provide food, provide oxygen, provide fresh drinking water as a life support system. The distance operation of these systems is called telepresence, which is, in essence, remote control. The prototype Lunar Greenhouse, so far, has been able to successfully produce plants, control the environment, control the hydroponic system, and communicate with us remotely. In the process, on a daily basis, we consume about 100 kilowatt hours of electricity. We then have to add about 0.5 kilograms of carbon dioxide for the plants to grow. In response, they provide about 0.3 kilograms of oxygen. Each 24-hour period, we are producing 50 liters of potable water from the transpiration water of the plants. These figures are based on approximately 100 kilograms of wet biomass, that is live plants, growing in the lunar greenhouse. Whether we're on another planet or on Earth, a controlled environment plant production system is simply plants growing in the system. You need to have the same experiences and information to be able to do that here or there. In the process, however, we offer the opportunities with the system to educate young people, to gain more knowledge about how the system operates, and to bring in other people, provide outreach about what we can do with controlled environments and where they may take us into the future. On Earth, we currently have a viable food production system growing vegetable products in greenhouses. We also will contribute to improving that technology in terms of resource recovery, resource utilization efficiency, higher quality products, multiple cropping systems, all what we learn from the life support system in the lunar prototype greenhouse can be applied here on Earth. There's opportunities for plants and control systems to provide other aspects to improve the quality of life. And this may be pharmaceuticals or nutraceuticals from plant phytochemicals that can be produced and extracted from the plant. It also can become a part of our environmental improvement by recycling wastewater through plant systems to provide potable water and possibly to extract chemicals that may be in that water in the plant and dispose of them properly. This future controlled environment technology is being demonstrated now. There's the South Pole Food Growth Chamber producing fresh vegetables for the crew at the station, which is enclosed for 6 to 8 months a year during the Antarctic winter. It's not only providing fresh vegetables, but there's a definite benefit to the psychological state of mind for those who are living and working in a dark and cold environment of Antarctica. So we see the benefits of green plants available to people who have to live and work in extreme climates. Controlled environments can also be utilized for algae production, for future development of biofuels in a controlled environment system. In addition, because controlled environments can be brought to almost any location, there is great interest in providing that in urban areas, for providing where the masses are living, growing the crops so that they're fresh, there's a very short transport distance, high quality, and then a sense of agriculture returning to the general norm of society. This is also a very exciting area. Now more than ever, we need the technology of controlled environments to help solve some of the problems in the world, which may range from feeding people to environmental cleanup to trying to have people survive on other planets with life support systems. At the Controlled Environment Agriculture Center at the University of Arizona, we are working very hard to educate young people, to develop more knowledge, and to put that knowledge together in applications and demonstrations so that it can be utilized effectively around the world.
Now, that is what our universities should be doing, and they are doing. The CEAC, the Controlled Environment Agricultural Center at the University of Arizona. That's Gene, Dr. Gene Giacomelli. Really, really great program. That is the kind of thing that would inspire young people. These hydroponic systems, which are designed to provide food and also an environment for enjoying the quality of life while you're off planet. This could be the future of farming. Definitely the future of off-planet survival for humans. In fact, if we are ever to return to exploring space, it makes no sense whatsoever to start anywhere but our own moon. The question has been, why have we not returned to the moon since 1972? And that's been the subject of many a conspiracy theory, ranging from, well, we never stopped going to the moon, we're still going to the moon, to the theory that we were literally chased off the moon and told never to return by someone or something who was already there. So as we get into the third hour of X Squared Radio, I want to consider a couple of things. We've made a good, effective case for the last hour and 50 minutes for colonizing the moon. It's financially feasible because the payback is there. The return on investment is not a thousandfold. It's a millionfold. The production of cheap solar panels, high-efficiency solar panels, to make your own electricity on the moon, on the Earth. The return of tons and tons of platinum, rhodium, palladium, even gold if it's there. These are definitely worth the investment. You know, gold's $1,000 an ounce. Rhodium is $50 a gram, which is about $1,500 an ounce. Palladium, platinum, very, very expensive metals. We use gazillions of pounds of this stuff every single month to make catalytic converters, to make our automobiles run cleaner, to make the retro rockets that we use in space. We use a dry chemical which goes through a catalyst. And then expands explosively. We use catalysts in lots of our chemical reactions here on Earth. And I got to add, a lot of that stuff's not very efficient. In other words, you don't really get a good yield. And it's largely because we don't generate a good vacuum, or it's too expensive to generate a good vacuum. And also, we are fighting gravity. But we don't have either one of those problems on the moon. We could make subassemblies or subsystems of more complex chemicals on the moon and then return them to Earth. We're shipping cheap ammonia, cheap coal, which would, I think, revitalize our coal industries because we're not burning so much anymore. We're using other forms of energy. And we're hard about shutting down all the coal power plants because they're so pollutive on our planet. But we could ship cheap coal and cheap ammonia to space, which wouldn't be lost. It would be converted into expensive raw materials and even finished goods to come back to Earth. Keep in mind, just because you have the mining operation, you also have to have the processing operations on the moon. This is a 100-year plan. My goodness, wouldn't it be wonderful to have a 100-year business plan to be busy about? Rather than hammering our world into weapons, we would be hammering it into exploring and being supportive of the race upwards and onwards, and we would be supporting ourselves here on the Earth. So I'd like to hear from you and see what you think about this. These two things. Oh, one more thing we're going to cover in our last hour. There is a theory that the Earth is hollow, that it's some kind of artificial craft, that we remember when the gas can, as it were, from the Eagle, when it took off from the moon, it jettisoned the can as it went up into orbit and docked with the orbiting module to return to Earth. But when the can, and this thing only weighed maybe 100 pounds by the time it was in the lunar gravitational field, and it was empty. By the time it was discarded and landed back on the surface of the moon, the geophones, these listening devices that were placed by the astronauts themselves to listen to the seismological activity of the moon, picked up the vibration of that can when it hit the surface. The interesting thing is that the moon rang like a bell for hours after that. It rang like a bell for hours after that. It wasn't a thud like a sack of potatoes or an empty gas can hitting the desert highway. The planet rang like a bell for hours. Now, there's been some thought, there have been some movies made about the moon being hollow. There's another Moon Scare film coming out in a few weeks called Moon. And I don't know if science fiction is the precursor to science fact. You tell me. As we begin our next hour, we'll talk a little bit about that hollow moon theory. And the idea, or at least the wonder, why did we not go back to the moon after 1972? Why were there two complete launch engines left behind in the garage? Crews, train, money spent, tracking systems ready, but we didn't go. We just didn't go. And China didn't go, and Russia didn't go. Everything just stopped at 1972. So we'll get our thoughts on that as we come back. We'll listen to a little bit of Enigma. Don't go away. We'll be right back with more X Squared Radio.
Bye.
And welcome back to Expert Radio. Third and final hour. It's May 29th. My AccuWindow forecast 78 degrees and starry, somewhere east of the Mississippi. In this hour, we're going to consider the case for returning to the moon. A couple of questions need to be answered. We have talked about the feasibility of growing food, creating light, of creating oxygen from the soil. Obviously, we have a little bit of precursor work to do with pioneers going there and setting things up. Obviously, there is the lure of mega, mega wealth, of a plethora of valuable metals, not just rare, but valuable in processes and making things. But we also have the question of why. Why did we leave in 1972? Why did we disband the greatest brain factory, the greatest brain trust ever assembled in the history of man? Why did we send all those smart people home? And we're about to do it again. We're about to lay several thousand people off at NASA with the end of the space shuttle program. Why have we not returned to the moon? Why has nobody gone back to the moon? There are those questions to answer. And we also want to consider the idea, and I think it's a great realization, that we are not going to set up habitats on the surface of the moon. We've seen all kinds of photographs of that. We've seen NASA animations and renderings of that, and it all looks great. It just looks like Antarctica with all of their, you know, insulated buildings sitting on rails down there on the ice, weathering away 90 below zero for the long six-month Antarctic winter. But this is not like that. This is a little bit more treacherous than that, because not only do we have extremes in temperature to deal with, whether we're being faced by the sun or not, we also have the advent of solar radiation in the form of high-energy proton particles and also cosmic rays. We also have microscopic meteorites that come whizzing in at some 25,000 miles an hour, sometimes creating a little bit of a gritty wind, like a dust storm on the surface, sure to eat away at even the best iron girders and wind seals. No, the best place to build that habitat is underground, landing inside of a crater and boring back into the wall in the darkness beneath the surface of the moon. But what is beneath the surface of the moon? We have a caller on line two that brought up the question earlier tonight, and we're going to discuss it. Welcome to the program, Tom.
Hey, Brooks, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing great. You know, hollow moon pops up from time to time. We sort of poke at it, but there aren't any facts to go by. What are your thoughts about the hollow moon?
Well, you know, there's so many anomalies up there. You know, with the two stages that they crashed into the moon and recorded the ringing, just the moon's orbit itself. I mean, it's almost a perfect circular orbit around the planet. The center of gravity is like 6,000 feet closer to the Earth than its geometric center. There are just way too many anomalies for it to be, I don't necessarily want to say completely artificial, but I feel it was placed there by some force or consciousness or something. It's just so anomalous, and then it rings, and you know, I'm on board with the hollow Earth theory, so and I also think that I think all celestial bodies have a hollow in them. When I just picture it in my mind, I look at the basic centrifugal force, and any orbiting body is going to be pushing its mass towards the outer perimeters.
Well, it does kind of make a little bit of sense. Not just the centripetal force, which is minimal at low rotation speeds, but we're looking at all the planets of our solar system at low rotation speeds. They may not always have been low. You know, these planets may have been spinning quite fast when they were first formed, and that fast rotation could have generated quite a bit of centripetal force until it stabilized into what we see now. But it's been, you know, it's been 4 to 5 billion years in stabilizing, and I would say, if you ask the occupants of Japan lately, it's still not too stable.
Right. Well, you know, a lot of people don't realize that the moon actually has quite a bit of seismic activity on it itself.
Well, I would imagine as it goes around the Earth that it's tugged on the Earth the same as the moon tugs on us. But the difference is that the moon sees a different side of Earth every second of the day. We always see the same side of the moon. The moon rotates on its axis at exactly the same rate with which it orbits Earth. So we never get to see the other side of the moon.
Another one of those anomalies that are really, really hard to explain.
Well, they say it's because the other side of the moon, its crust is much thicker. But wouldn't that indicate that the darn thing's hollow if they're saying that the crust is thicker on that side than it is our side? I mean, there may be tectonic activity because any, you know, spatial body is going to have tidal gravity messing with it all the time. But does it have any volcanic activity?
Yeah, it has none. It's apparently just a cold rock.
I would say so, but it is evidently very wealthy in minerals. And I did hear in the first clip that I played that one of the lunar missions actually drilled into the ground 3 meters. That's about 10 feet. And that's a lot to drill for two dudes standing on the surface for 6 hours.
All right.
Do you recall them encountering any difficulty doing that?
Oh, yes. They had all sorts of problems drilling into it. It was extremely hard. Let's see, what they run into. They ran into titanium and, I can't remember all the minerals that they ran into, but it was they found it much harder to drill than would be expected.
Well, we learned right off it wasn't made of green cheese, that's for sure.
Now, right.
What do you think about the idea of landing in one of the big craters, which, by the way, those crater walls are, you know, like 1,000 feet high? What would be wrong with just landing on the surface of the crater and then boring horizontally into the crater wall for that first habitat?
Well, you know, I think if we did some really good mapping there and we actually got some of the good photographs that they've taken, we might find that there's already places that are under the shelter of incoming asteroids or nano asteroids or whatever you want to label them. But I think there's already plenty of places there where you could just set up camp right underneath some rock shelf or something.
Well, that's interesting. So you think that there would be either fissures or volcanic tubes that already kind of make a natural passageway that we could make use of without having to bring a big boring machine up there?
Exactly. You know, I've got an 8-inch Celestron telescope, and the moon is one of my most favorite objects to look at. And there is a lot more going on there than what most people realize. I've seen some bizarre anomalous lights myself on the moon.
You mean like parked on the moon or traveling across the moon?
Parked on the moon.
Wow.
Let's see, I actually posted a YouTube video, this was a year and a half, almost 2 years ago now, and it was a half moon, And I had taken, I was just looking at it with my Celestron, and I noticed that there was something flashing on the dark side, and I just took the vision off to where all I was seeing it was the dark side, and I was amazed. It was like city glow.
No kidding. So there was actually light coming off of the surface of the moon in the dark portion of the moon.
Correct. It looked like city glow. I mean, I've flown enough at night that I know what city glow kind of looks like, and I had no other explanation, but it looked like city glow. There was I had a couple guys there with me with their telescopes, and all of us trained in on it, and all of us saw it. So,
that's amazing. Yeah, I'd like to see that YouTube video.
I'll send you a link to it.
Some people, and I can't disclose. Well, I can go ahead and disclose the source. Nothing's classified on this program. One of the mechanics that was working for me, his name was Ben Thomas, rather gifted young man, has an uncle who is a colonel and has been a colonel for a long time with the Air Force, and he's stationed at NORAD. And every once in a while, the colonel comes home for Christmas, and they're talking, and one. Christmas, a little bit too much Christmas cheer, and he admitted that the Air Force had been flying missions back and forth to the moon for 12 years.
Yeah. Well, I've suspected for quite a while that our secret space program has been going there for a very long time, if not, there's all sorts of evidence. I mean, if you want to jump down the rabbit hole and look at all the different conspiracy theories, the Nazis have been going there since the 50s, you know. So it depends on how deep you want to go, and you got to use a lot of discernment with that stuff. But some of it resonates.
Yeah, but they're not going by putting men on top of a rocket and launching them up there, because we're not that.
Oh, no. No, there's technology that's been out there for a long time that makes rockets obsolete. And we just look at what we do know, things like Tesla's stuff. We do know that he had technology that could generate power from the zero point. And we know what happened with that. Where else could that technology go? If somebody were to take that thread and run with it, what else could that basis of, the theoretical basis that he worked on, where else could that have taken us? Anti-gravity? All sorts of different sorts of propulsion? It could have gone where it probably has gone and been bought up by the powers that be.
Well, I think that that stuff does exist. I think that the rapidly spinning, almost gyroscopic, 35,000-40,000 RPM flywheels that they have, especially for the gyroscopes, but also for the KERS system, kinetic energy recovery systems. They generate a lot more, I won't say thrust. They just seem to change the local space-time around the immediate area of the object that's spinning really fast. And it seems like over time, and we're talking about several hours, the vehicle seems to travel more distance in the same amount of time than it should have. And that's not really velocity, because it isn't really traveling faster. But, speed we measure in terms of distance, miles per hour, parsecs per, light years. We measure it in terms of time. It's the time that's being shifted because of the spinning object. And that's the best explanation I can come up with.
Yeah, there's a lot out there. Our physics is the Newtonian physics is old school now. I think we need to get these ingenious and creative brains working out there and look at this stuff with a fresh set of eyes and throw out all that they've learned before and start from scratch and see what we can come up with, because there's so much here that so much potential here to be tapped into. And just me as a layman, a complete layman when it comes to physics and science, you know, I see that there's a lot of potential there.
Well, it's one thing to say, you know, throw it all out, but we've actually validated a lot of it, and we could stand upon it. And I'm going to say that the things that are out there, like recharging batteries with very little power input, doesn't really violate the laws of physics. We are simply transferring energy from another state, another dimension, as it were, into our dimension. Yeah, we call it zero point, but let's not get too scary about it. Energy can be neither created nor destroyed, but it can be moved around. And it can, you know, a pathway provided for it to enter one dimension from another dimension. And maybe that's what Tesla discovered. It's hard to say. We don't have his notes. What I do see, at least in my industry, is, well, one of my friends, Rand Paul, who's a senator from Kentucky, can get a little vocal from time to time, but he has observed that government is in the way. It's not that they don't say no necessarily. It's that they never say yes. They just don't allow some of this technology to make it to commercial stage. And unfortunately, with our economy, the way it's set up, you have to have capital to make things happen. You got to have capital to put it into production and to get it through R&D into prototype, get the prototype into production, get the production to the consumer. And that capital, it just isn't available anymore. It just doesn't come like that.
Right. Yeah, that's one of the sad truths about our society. So,
well, we may have, as a society, as a race of mankind, we may have reached the useful end of money. There's got to be a different way to transfer the value of one's work from the place at which you earn your paycheck to the end place where that value is gonna see its resting place. There just has to be a way, because the money, the actual creation of it, the printing of it, the managing of it, the valuing of it, the exchange of it between one nation or another is actually what's limiting our world of nations into becoming one planet.
I will agree wholeheartedly with that. There's a lot of people that have really good ideas on how the society could change paradigms into a cashless or a moneyless type society. Contributionism. I really like that idea. Ramon and I are always trying to brainstorm on new paradigm ideas and things that can bring our world into a new, more user-friendly version of Earth, you know, Earth 2.0 or whatever you want to call it. I know there's ways out there. And
the interesting ways to do that, Tom, is to add another planet to the mix.
Yeah. That would do it. You know, that would do it. If you know, but like you said, we got to get the cash thing out of the way and, get people to start get passionate about doing things like going to the moon. Let's set up that base up there. I would love to go for, you know, take a couple week vacation in Mir Imbri the dark side of the moon, or the far side of the moon. Go take a tour. You know, that'd be awesome.
I would like to go up there and work. I mean, I'd go up there for a year. I could, you know, I won't atrophy much. I think like you do. I think that, you know, we have a society of the ultra wealthy, the billionaire class, and they got there because what they created or systems that they created added enough value to their process that they were able to accumulate that much wealth. I think that's wonderful. I think it's great. What they do with that wealth, if they make it work, if they make it, you know, use the wealth that they have personally accumulated to, you know, allow others to see their ideas to fruition. And I don't mean going out and buying cheeseburgers for everybody. That's a complete upset of the whole system. You can't just go into a system where people are not productive and take away their dignity by giving them enough to get through one day. That's just not right. That's not being nice or kind. But if you give them a pack of seeds and say, here, go plant these, show them how to plant it, show them how to make seed in addition to what their food is, you've cured that person of hunger forever, not just one day.
Yeah, but, you know, getting that group of people to get the altruistic viewpoint is, and away from the greed viewpoint, or the sure thing deals that they're willing to invest in, you know, that can be a challenge.
Well, but it's not just the billionaire. It's any person who has the potential to be a billionaire. You know, I talk to people who don't have kids and they own property and they resent paying the property tax for schools. And because they say, well, I don't get any benefit from that, so I shouldn't have to pay it. And I say, but you do get benefit from that because we now have an educated youth and they are the ones that do all the work in our society, whether they're teachers or whether they're farmers or mechanics or beauticians or dentists. You would have none of them in your society if you didn't pay for the education.
That's right. That's right. I will agree with that. Yeah, we all have to do our part. And, you know, you have to have a broader vision. People have to have a broader vision of what's really going on here. And contributionism, I mean, everybody has to contribute something, whether it's their labor or their ideas or their money. You know, for us to take the next step into the millennium that we just began and see this thing change into a more positive planet for all of us, that mindset has to take hold. I mean, we have to get I like the word contributionism. I mean, everybody needs to contribute something.
Well, they need to for more than just money. They need to for their own dignity as well. You know, a human being who feels like he's not adding anything to the system and yet he is getting benefit from it will automatically lose his self-esteem.
Right. That or more, I was going to make a smart aleck comment, that or go watch some more TV or something. Yeah. Distract themselves.
Yeah.
Let's get distracted with all the thoughts that are going through my mind. I don't like who I am, so I'm just going to go watch some stupid sitcom or something.
Yep, I know exactly where you're coming from there. So, you know, the moon, when I was growing up, when Kennedy made his announcement, every boy, I think, every boy wanted to be an astronaut. It just was. I mean, come on. I was asked, I think, maybe the third grade, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I didn't even hesitate. I said, I want to be an asteroid miner. I want to go out into space, grab onto an asteroid, haul it to a processing plant, and make that happen. That's 2 years one way in space. I mean, that's just, that's exactly what I wanted to do, though. I thought, you know, nothing could be more fantastic than to be in space. And it sounds all cold and dark and everything, but you never know what you're going to see or what you're going to meet or what you're going to hear. That's the place to be. I mean, being on Earth is wonderful. It's a paradise in space. This is really heaven. we really think about it, who wants to be on a cloud playing a harp forever? This is the place to be. My gosh, you get to taste chocolate and surf waves and talk to women. And I mean, my goodness, yep. this is heaven.
Yep, it definitely is. Definitely is. And it's quite an amazing place. I tell you what, just doing what I'm able to do with the telescopes and looking out into the cosmos, it's like, wow, this is such an amazing existence. This whole thing that we're in here, we find ourselves in here. And just looking out my window and seeing trees and it's just amazing. I mean, this is all so amazing. How did this all get put together? It is something to keep us completely occupied to, I mean, the wonder.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it just takes my breath away, whether I'm looking at the desert, the deserts of Idaho. I've never seen such spectacular sunsets, just unbelievable. And to listen to the ocean crash, I could just listen to it for hours. Or listen to the wind blow through pine trees up in the mountains. There's no sound like that anywhere on Earth.
Have you been to the Badlands in South Dakota?
I have driven through the Badlands of South Dakota. That is spectacular. Bryce Canyon, Utah is breathtaking.
Yes, yes. Yeah, it's an amazing world, amazing world. But, you know, I'm kind of with you. I would like to go up there. I'd like to go to the moon. I'd like to go out in the stars. I feel an affinity for it myself, so. That's why you'll find me whenever there happens to be a clear sky here in the northwest, which is pretty rare these days. Like tonight, I will not be able to see the shuttle go by because we are completely socked in. But you'll find me with my eyes stuck to my telescope.
Well, you should move to North Carolina. They have the most clear night skies of any state on the eastern seaboard.
I've been getting the itch to get out of the Northwest here lately.
Well, you go to New Mexico; they always have clear skies.
Yeah. So, okay, Brooke. Well, I'm gonna get off here and give anybody else a chance to get in here if they want to.
I appreciate you. Tell Ramon I'm proud of him. I'm glad to welcome him here on Sunday nights.
Oh, yes. Great. We're very happy to be there. All right. Good night, Brooks.
All right. Thanks, Tom. Good night. So we have this set of energy, this set of concentration, which we call Earth. We're tied to it. We're occupied to it. We measure it in terms of the Dow Jones Industrial Average. By the way, you know there's only one company that's still an original member of the Dow Jones Industrial Average when it was created. Do you know what that company is? I'm not seeing any texts out there. I'll tell you what it is. It's GE. Yeah, GE, none other than General Electric, the one that received billions of dollars of interest-free money from the Fed, all those dollars that came back from the banks, from the bailouts. Instead of paying down the debt, the Fed just sent it out to shore up the credit markets, they say. GE didn't even need the money, but they took it interest-free, and some of it they actually loaned back to the Fed at 3% interest. That's pretty smart business, isn't it? And a couple of months later, Obama makes the CEO of GE the head of economic recovery. And GE is the only original company that's a member of the Dow Industrial Average. So they've been doing pretty well over time. And maybe General Electric has enough money to put this city on the moon. Maybe Exxon or Mobil or Shell or one of the other private investors has the money to put this complex on the moon and begin reaping the benefits from these minerals. I would hope that it would be a private company. I would hope that it wouldn't be a military government that would set this up and control it. And I would hope that that private entity would colonize the moon and then lose control of that colony, much as the way Britain colonized the United States and then lost control of the United States. And that the moon would become its own entity and its own bargaining chip in space, because it certainly would be the premium place for heavy lifting. A rocket, the Saturn V rocket that can lift 60 or 70,000 pounds by itself, strap a few of those together and a couple solid boosters, and you've got a couple hundred thousand pounds of payload. But on the moon, they would have 1.2 million pounds of payload. Imagine the ship that you could lift into space for exploration. Imagine the complex and the experience that you would have when you went to Mars, when you went to Mercury, when you went to planets outside our own solar system. Imagine the experience, the wealth of technology and supply and expert materials that you would have from having a moon base. It's just almost beyond imagination, which is where we often go on this program, and that's fine. I do want to let you all know that I appreciate you as listeners. Many of you have renewed your archive subscriptions, and I think that is wonderful. That's what helps keep the lights on here. As you know, we've given a great facelift to xsquaredradio.com, and I'm just now getting used to posting the archives on that new format. So if you'll just give me some time, myself and my webmaster, Dylan Case, by the way, I highly recommend him. If any of you are looking for a good webmaster, I can recommend one. Once we get used to putting that up there, then the archives will resume. We have recorded a couple of shows, and they're not up there yet. Also, had a nice long interview with Harvey Rockman. Harvey Rockman is a producer, a movie producer. And he was the one that solicited the screenplay from the books, which I wrote and I sent to him, and he responded very well to that. And we'll see where it goes from there. I'm not going to tell you what it's called or where it's going or anything else about it because, well, that's just the Hollywood way. I didn't know anything about that till I spoke to a couple of people in the business, but you just don't give out that information. So what we will do is wait till we get a director and a star and wait till we get some readings going and raise some money, and we'll see if we can't make a film out of it. Because let me tell you, I think, I'm biased, I know, the screenplay came out pretty well. Not just the scenes. There's a lot of action in it. There's a lot of great dialogue in it. I've seen some pretty good movies lately. Great screen effects, wonderful scene direction, and the lines were horrible. The lines were sixth grade at best. Nothing to write home about. Some movies were directed okay, a little bit disjointed, but the lines were phenomenal. Really good, memorable lines. And some of them were so funny you just had to laugh yourself out of your chair. You got to remember some of these lines for life because they're just premium. That's what's in this movie. Just has a lot of really, really good dialogue, really, really good scenes, and everything in the movie is true. That's right. Some of the conversations between the people, yes, we took artistic license with that, but when I wrote the scenes, when I put the information in there, when I put the stuff out of the books in there, what has happened, what will happen, it's all true. It isn't based on a true story. It is a true story. So when you see it on the screen, you're really going to be fascinated with it. Tonight we have talked about not just colonizing the moon. Heck, lots of people talk about that all the time. What we talked about were there are some scientific challenges to be sure, and the scope, the scale of those challenges are beyond the ordinary economic mind. We're not talking about millions of dollars or billions of dollars or dollars at all. We're talking about a multinational global effort for the race of man to survive. Not just pushing out into space, colonizing other planets in our present genetic form. Not at all. I mean, being out there in space, not 200 miles like the space station or 23,500 miles like our weather satellites are or our communication satellites. I'm talking about 250,000 miles away, out in space, on the biggest satellite we have orbiting our Earth, the moon. Being out there and not watching the moon, but watching the Earth from out there. Now we have a perspective from deep space that we can see what's coming to the Earth. We don't have to wait for the Earth to revolve around to see what's coming. The moon has a perspective of the Earth, everything except just the pinpoint that's behind the Earth, that's precluded by the Earth itself, shadowed by the Earth. The rest of space we could see from the moon. We could warn the Earth of something coming. We could protect the Earth from something coming. And we might be able to have enough momentum going in 20 or 30 years that we could even escape or survive as a race. And I think that goes above and beyond the little squabbles we have, like, I don't want to see my Social Security check dwindle one penny for those guys to go to the moon. I don't want to go to the moon. I want to spend the money here. I think there's plenty of that no matter what level of society you're in. Whether you're in the billionaire class or whether you're in the millionaire class or whether you're in the thousandaire class or whether you're all the way down where we are as working people, there is that attitude that we can't afford it. We don't want to do it. We don't want to share what we have with anyone else. So, by the way, Tom sent me a link, which I was going to post on the website, that shows the city lights on the moon in the dark. He writes me back, says the link is not working, but as soon as he gets that link working, he's going to send it to me, I'm sure. And I'm going to send it to you, and you can see what an amateur astronomer with an 8-inch Celestron scope can see from Earth. If he's trained on the moon long enough, eventually you're going to see something. And what he says he's got on film is city glow on the moon. Similar to, what was the movie Contact, when Elle came out of one of the warps. She looked through the transparent side of the capsule in which she was riding, and the thing came to an abrupt stop. She looked down and saw the city glow below, and she recorded on her camera, "They're alive," and then off she went again through another wormhole. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about looking 250,000 miles away, but with a little magnification, you can get right down almost mountaintop high on the moon. And then you can see if there's any radiation coming back from the moon in the dark. And that's what we'd like to see. We look up at the moon affectionately and is the subject of a lot of affection on our planet. But if you look at it long enough, sooner or later you're going to see something up there. It is May 29th, 2011. Tonight has been X Squared Radio. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew, coming to you live somewhere east of the Mississippi. By the way, I drove over the Mississippi a couple of days ago on Interstate 10 down there past Baton Rouge, And we're not talking about thousands of acres flooded. We're talking about thousands of square miles flooded. And we're also hearing reports of earthquakes along the Mississippi River. Yeah, earthquakes. Now, this isn't California. This isn't the Pacific Rim. This is the New Madrid Fault. It goes from the Gulf of Mexico all the way to North Dakota. Yeah, it splits the country in two. In 1811, there was a quake. I think I'm right on that year. There was a quake that was so violent on the Mississippi River that it made it run backwards, and it formed a new lake called Real Foot Lake. If there were an earthquake now, with as flooded as it is, I shudder to think what the results might be. We have had over 1,000 tornadoes this spring. Over 1,000 tornadoes this spring. Some of them stayed on the ground for 150 miles before they came up. Some of them 50 miles, some of them 20 miles. Many towns like Joplin, Missouri, aren't there anymore. They're just a bomb went off. A wind bomb took everything apart. We've had floods beyond what we've had in the last 77 years in this area. And we've built levees since then. We've built dams since then to manage it. And still it went beyond what it went almost 77 years ago. Add to that one more thing. Earthquakes, and you've got a situation, a real situation, one that the insurance companies themselves might not even be able to bear. We'll talk a little bit about it next Sunday. We'll be into June. In June, we are going to start having authors back on the program. I am digesting several books as we speak. As you know, my time has been occupied doing other things with wrenches and voltmeters. Now that period of time is done for a few weeks anyway till we hear the results of that back. So I am back on the radio every Sunday and we'll begin to post these archives back up. But June, we're going to have authors back on the program. So tell your friends, spread the word. Don't forget to re-up your archives. That's what helps us keep the lights on here and keep the commercials away. That's why you get all this time with me right here on X Squared Radio. We'll see you next week, my friends. Thank you so much. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day. And before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.